to speak here. And I'm actually, well, since you invited me, I'm actually moved to Nordita. Oh. So I'm not at Nordita, but as Shota said, I will be talking about integrability in ADS3 CFT2 and the conformal field theory of the Higgs branch of the CFT2. So here's a brief outline.
Is the microphone on?
I thought so. Yes. Well, I'm not sure if they're in the speaker or something, but the microphone is supposed to be on. Okay. So first, I will give a brief introduction to the ADS3 CFT2 correspondence and to integrability in this setting. Then I will discuss the D1, D5 system from the perspective of 2D gauge theory. In particular, I will discuss the UV Lagrangian of this system and the flow to the IR and the Coulomb and Higgs branch of this theory. Then I will, in more detail, describe the conformal field theory that we end up on after this flow on the Higgs branch, the relation to the ADHM sigma model, and an effective action at the origin of the Higgs branch. And finally, I will discuss a spin chain picture of local operators in this CFT and how one can compute the one loop dilatation operator of the theory in a special limit in the subsector. So there are two geometric backgrounds preserving 16 supersymmetries, ADS3 backgrounds. So there's either an ADS3 S3 T4 background, or you can make an ADS3 S3 S3 S1 background. And those are dual, according to ADS CFT, to some two-dimensional conformal field theories with 4,4 supersymmetry. You either have the small 4,4 or the large 4,4 superconformal algebra on the dual side. Now, in the first case, the CFT with its small 4,4 symmetry has one description in terms of a sigma model of on the symmetric NT4 orbital fault or deformation thereof. Well, in the second example, with a large 4,4 subsymmetry, very little is known about it. There's no explicit description of this CFT at the moment. There's a lot of interesting physics in this ADS3 CFT2 correspondence. So the D1 D5 system appears, as you probably know, in many places. This duality is an example with less supersymmetry than, say, the n=4 case. So n=4 Cpyang-Mills and ADS5S5. There is just 16 supersymmetries instead of 32. Moreover, in the gauge theory description, there is not only adjoint matter, but also fundamental matter in the CFT, on the gauge theory side. And there are also solutions one couldn't consider, such as the BTC black hole. On the more technical side, these backgrounds can be supported not only by Ramond-Ramond flux, but also by Neverschwarz-Neverschwarz flux, or some linear combination of the two. Now, one novelty in this background, if you compare it to ADS5, S5, say, is that you have three directions. So you have a flat direction, so T4 here and then S1 here. And these lead to massless modes in the spectrum if you go to light gauge, which is something that does not appear in ADS5, S5 and gives some technically interesting challenges when studying these backgrounds. It's also interesting to study in these backgrounds because the dual CFT is a two-dimensional CFT, and there are many powerful methods developed for studying such CFTs. And well, the backgrounds are large. There's a large parameter space of backgrounds. So you have, for example, both a coupling constant and the amount of or the sort of three-form flux. And then in this background, there's an extra parameter describing the relative radius of one S3 compared to the other one. Now, another interesting thing with these two backgrounds is that string theory on these backgrounds can be described as a super constant sigma model. So in one case, you take the supergroup PSU1,1/2 squared, and you divide by some diagonal SL2 times SU2. And the second case, instead, take the D21 alpha exceptional super Lie algebra or super Lie group, two copies of it, and again, you divide by the diagonal, in this case, SL2 times SU2 times SU2. And then you just add some U1 factors corresponding to the S1 or D4. Now, what makes these cosets very special is that they come equipped with a Z4 automorphism. And that means that the classical sigma model on this background is integrable. So that's a reason to try to study these models using integrability. So my goal is to use integrability to solve the spectral problem in a similar way that people have been trying for the last, I don't know, 13 years, and more or less succeeded in understanding the spectral problem of ADS5S5. So what we want to find is the energy spectrum of strings moving in these backgrounds, ADS backgrounds, ADS3 backgrounds. But just the energy spectrum of free strings. So in other words, we send the string coupling to zero, or if you want in the gate theory language, you take the large n limit. In Lipkin gauge, diagonalizing this, so you want the energy spectrum, you can translate that to the Wellschmidt spectrum. So a Wellschmidt Hamiltonian, which in the Lipkin gauge is just the same as the space-time energy minus some angular momentum on the sphere. Now, on the string theory side, the last few years, we have been looking a lot of what we can do with integrability. Particularly, we have found the all loop S matrix, and we know the dispersion relation of excitations in Lipkin gauge, so Wellschmidt excitations with this target space. But today, I want to instead focus on the CFT2 side. Sorry? Yes, we know the full S matrix now, since recently. But today I want to talk about the CFT side. And I want to look at the simplest gauge, which is type 2B, so the CFT dual of type 2B string theory on the ADS3, S3, T4 background, corresponding supported by pure Ramon-Ramon freeform flux. And I want to ask the question, how could we use integrability for the spectral problem in the dual CFT? So before I get into that, I want to introduce a description of the CFT I'm talking about. So the basis, our description is just the D1, D5 system. So you take NC D1 brains, some directions in 10-dimensional space. And you take NF D5 brains, and you wrap four of the directions on a T4, the four torus, and then they coincide with the D1 brains in the remaining two directions. Now, the near horizon limit of this geometry gives exactly ADS3, S3 here, and the T4. So on the string side, this is the background we want to study. On the other hand, on the world volume of the D1 brains, we obtain a 4,4 UNC gauge theory, which contains both adjunct and fundamental matter. And this 4,4 gauge theory is not conformal, but it flows to some non-trivial conformal fixed point where we get a small 4,4 superconformal. So So one way of obtaining just the starting gauge theory is to think about a 60, 1,0 gauge theory living in these four dimensions, whose R symmetry is related to an SU2 sitting in the SO4, rotating these four transverse directions. And then we dimensionally reduce that to two dimensions. So we end up here with the 4,4 gauge theory in direction 0 and 1. And to start with, it would have gauge group U and C times U and F. I mean, because there's a stack of D1 brains and a stack of D5 brains. So if there were just a stack of D1 brains, the theory would be just the dimensional reduction of 10D Supiang Mills, which would be a 2D 8,8 Supiang Mills theory. But the additional D5 brains break this down to 4,4. So it breaks half of the supersymmetry. So what is the field content of this theory? So firstly, there are D1, D1 strings transforming in the adjoint of U and C. And they give rise to a 4,4 vector multiplet and a 4,4 hyper, or two 4,4 hypermultiplets. And this is just the reduction of the 8,8 vector multiplet to by breaking half the supersymmetry. So the vector multiplet consists of four scalars, two left and two right, four left and four right moving fermions, the gauge field, which is not dynamic in two dimensions, and some auxiliary scalars. And the hypermultiplets consist of two bosons, one left and one right moving fermion. And this is, of course, just the field content of a 4D n equal to 2 vector and hypermultiplet reduced to two dimensions. Similarly, the D1, D5 strings are bifundamental under the UNC times UNF. And we get two hypermultiplets, which are bifundamental. And finally, there should be D5, D5 strings. But we can take a scaling limit where the volume of the torus is large so that these decouple from the system. And in fact, the would-be gauge group U and F just acts as global symmetry. So we end up with the gauge theory with gauge symmetry U and C and a global U and F. And the field content is a vector multiplet, some adjoint hypers, and some fundamental hypers, which are also fundamental or under the global symmetry. So just like in a four-dimensional n equal to 2 theory, the action is completely determined by supersymmetry once I specify the matter content and symmetries. So the UV Lagrangian can be split up into three parts containing the different multiplets. So there is some L phi, where phi is the scalar of the vector multiplet. So this is just the vector multiplet Lagrangian. And then the hypermultiplets couple through the vector multiplet only. And all the interactions are determined just from gauge symmetry. It's just the normal gauge couplings plus supersymmetrization. So for the vector multiplet, for example, you would just have a Young-Mills term, a kinetic term for the scalars, plus fermions. And similarly, for the hypers, you have just the kinetic terms, a quartic term, which is just a reduction of the four-dimensional covariant derivative down to two dimensions, and some coupling to the D. And similar for the fundamental hypers. However, in two dimensions, this is not conformal. In particular, the Young-Mills coupling is dimensionful. It has dimension 1. And if this coupling has dimension 1, then the kinetic term, at least written like this, seems to be an irrelevant operator in this action. So hence this model will flow when we go to the IR. So there will be some non-trivial flow to some infrared fixed point. Now, there are two separate branches of this theory, exactly like in an n equal to 2 theory in four dimensions. There's a Coulomb branch where the scalars in the vector multiplet take some expectation value. And in the D1, D5 system, you can think about them as the D1 and D5 brains separated from each other in the transverse direction. On the other hand, there's a Higgs branch where the scalars in the hypermultiplet take expectation values. And here, the D1 brains move around or dissolve inside the D5 brain. Note that in two dimensions, a scalar has dimension 0. So in the difference to the four-dimensional case is that here, you have a moduli space where you can take some expectation value without breaking conformal symmetry, actually. Now, in both these cases, so we can go out on one of these branches, give some expectation value to some scalars, either in the vector multiplet or hypermultiplet. And then we can ask, where do we flow in the IR? And the answer is that we flow to two different CFTs. And the reason, one way to see this is that the resulting CFTs have different SO4 R symmetries. In both cases, you get some 4,4 superconformal theory, but their R symmetry is not the same. So you can't join them up. Instead, they are just, the IR theory is just a sum of two distinct CFTs. So if we want to study the CFT, we should choose which one we want to study. And the one we want to study is the Higgs branch of the theory, because that's the one that's dual to the string theory in the vacuum of ADS3, S3, T4. So that's the CFT I want to study here. So this is one description of this would be some, it's not very important. Because this has 4,4 supersymmetry, the moduli space metric here is hyperkähler. But I'm not sure if that's important. So how do we describe this theory on the Higgs branch? So as I mentioned before, the kinetic term for the vector multiplet is an irrelevant operator here. So Witten argued a long time ago that to describe the IR theory on the Higgs branch, the only thing you need to do is drop the kinetic term. So that flows away, and your remaining Lagrangian is completely still completely determined by supersymmetry and consists of just the Lagrangian for the two hypermultiplets, still coupling to the vector multiplet fields, but we have dropped the kinetic term for them. Now this theory, this Lagrangian is exactly marginal, provided we let the fields of the vector multiplet carry so-called geometric dimensions. So that means that the gauge field and the scalars have dimension 1, the fermion has dimension 3/2, and the auxiliary D has dimension 2. So this is, in other words, the same dimension that it would have in four dimensions. On the other hand, the hypermultiplets carry canonical dimensions, so that the scalar have dimension 0 and the fermions have dimension 1/2. And if the fields carry these dimensions, then this action is exactly marginal. But because we dropped the kinetic term for the vector multiplet, the fields of the vector multiplet now enters as just auxiliary fields. So they have some algebraic equations of motions. And they actually only enter quadratically in fields. So since they only enter quadratically, it's straightforward to just integrate them out. So you can just integrate out the phi, say, or the whole vector multiplet. And what this would do is reduce the Lagrangian I had on the previous side, exactly to this called ADHM, the Lagrangians of the ADHM sigma model. So this is a sigma model with 4.4 supersymmetry, whose moduli space, which I denote N, N C, N F, is the model, or sorry, the target space is the moduli space of N C instantons in four-dimensional S U N F gauge theory. So this is exactly the how you get the string theory description of the ADHM construction. So in particular, you can derive normal D and F flatness conditions, and they're equivalent to the constraints you get in the ADHM construction. However, this ADHM sigma model has a small instanton singularity. So if we think about the target space as this modular space of instantons in 4D, then when the size of the instanton shrinks to zero, the metric blows up, becomes singular. So the states localized near the origin of the Higgs branch, or in other words, near the small instanton singularity, is not well described by the ADHM sigma model. Unfortunately, these are exactly the strings, the states that we are interested in if we want to understand free strings in the dual of just free strings moving in ADS3. So we need a different description of these states. And again, we can find in a paper by Witten a nice description of what you do instead. So instead of integrating out the vector multiplets, you integrate out the hypermultiplets. So doing this reduces your effective action, or your action in the IR. So I take the action I showed you before, and I integrate out the bifundamental hypermultiplets. And I end up with some effective action, Lagrangian for the scalars, or for the fields in the vector multiplet, and I still have left the adjoint hypermultiplet sitting here. And there's a factor nf here, these arrows pointing weirdly, but there's a factor of nf in front, which I put in front of the effective Lagrangian of the vector multiplet, and f is just because that's how many hypermultiplets I have integrated out. But it also, since I also want to point out that since it's sitting like a factor in front of this effective Lagrangian, it acts as a coupling constant of the theory. So in particular, if you take a large NF limit now, it would be possible to make a perturbative expansion in 1 over NF.
So it's non-local.
But it is non-local, yes. But you can do perturbation theory. So this effective Lagrangian is just your standard. So one way to get it is to make, it just comes from a one loop determinant, which you get when you integrate out. So when you integrate over the quadratic action, which is quadratic in terms of the hypermultiplet. So you can write it in terms of, you can write it as a some perturbative expansion like this. Once we do that, we've gotten rid of the bifundamental hypermultiplet, but our vector multiplet has again become dynamical. Now, the two-point function of the fields in the vector multiplets are completely determined by conformal symmetry because we know what their dimension have to be. So the scalars have dimension 1, so we have some 1 over x squared. Similarly, the gauge field has dimension 1, and the auxiliary d has dimension 2. So it's two-point functions, just is 1 over x to the 4. So in this way, actually effectively, the gauge field, which in original theory didn't have any dynamics because it's a gauge field in two dimensions, now actually has a non-trivial two-point function. And the same thing is true for the auxiliary field, which of course originally didn't have any dynamics. It again has a non-trivial two-point function now. And the same should therefore by symmetry be true. So the equations of the motions for the fermions are changed. It's not just your Dirac equation. So the equation of motion no longer projects out half of the degrees of freedom. So you also get correspondingly 4 more fermionic degrees of freedom. And the interactions in this theory, these are interactions between, say, vector multiplets. I will write them as some fat blob like this. But that just indicates some expansion where I have some loop of the field I integrated out. So either a boson and a fermion in a loop. And similarly, you have some interaction between a scalar and the gluon, again, just mediated by the hypermultiplets, which we have integrated out. So the resulting theory has two parameters, where it had all the way, all the time, nc, so the number of d1 braids, which is here, is the number of colors. So the vector multiplet fields are adjoint on the u and c. And it has nf, which was the number of d5 braids, but which we saw now appears as a coupling constant in the effective action for the vector multiplet. So in particular, we can take the scaling limit where we send both nc and nf to infinity. In particular, we take a large number of colors, so we can take a planar limit. But we scale them so that nc over nf is some finite value. And if we take this value small, we can make the lambda is like an Atoft coupling. So we can make a small lambda expansion, which is planar. So that's the theory we want to study. So what has this to do with integrability? So as I explained in the beginning, on the string theory side of the ADS-CFT duality, we wanted to study the energy spectrum of free strings. So on the CFT side, that just corresponds to the spectrum of local gauge invariant operators. And to find the spectrum, that's just the same thing as diagonalizing the dilatation operator, the operator that measures the dimensions. Now, because our effective description now is in terms of adjoint fields, so very similar to, say, 4D gauge theory description, in the planar limit I described, correlation functions are dominated by single trace operators. So I can construct a gauge invariant operator by just taking the trace over some collection of adjoint fields. And the adjoint field I have to play with is the fields of the vector multiplet or the field strength multiplet, some 4 scalars, fermions, field strength, and the formerly auxiliary D. And additionally, I have the adjoint hypermultiplet, which is just a scalar and some fermions. And I can act with covariant derivatives on these fields. Now, there are, of course, many such operators I can write down. So I just insert here for each psi, I just insert one of these adjoint fields. But these various operators, as you know, mix by renormalization. So I write down some basis of bare operators, but then my renormalized operators are given by some matrix C times my basis of bare operators. And if I know this matrix, so if I know how the local operators are normalized, I can extract the dilatation operator. So it's just d log c divided by d log mu. And that's the operator I want to diagonalize to know the spectrum of the theory. And this can, of course, be also be expanded in a perturbative expansion. So here I'm doing a perturbative expansion in nc over an f. So I have some tree-level result, just not d0. And I have some one-loop anomalous dimension, dd, plus some higher-order corrections, which I won't care about today. Now, from the structure of perturbation theory, similar to what happens in planar limit of in four dimensions, at one loop, the dilatation operator will only can be written as a sum over operators that act on neighboring fields here. So first there is a term where I just do something with these two, the next term do something with the next two, and so on. And that leads to natural interpretation as this dilatation operator of this dilatation operator as a local Hamiltonian acting on a spin chain. Again, in the same way as in n equal to 4 Cpn Mills. So this operator is a Hamiltonian. And instead of local operators, I think about my states as a spin chain, but that's just a change of name. Right. So the sites of this spin chain, so the fields of the theory, the adjoint fields, they transform under PSU 1.1/2², which is just the global part of the small 4.4 superconformal algebra. In particular, the vector multiplet transforms in some fundamental representation, which I call minus a half a half. Tensor the same thing under the two copies of PSU 1.1.2. While the adjoint hypers transform in some reducible representation of this algebra. So in particular, there's a left and the right moving part. So something that's chiral, charged on just one copy of PC 1.1.2, and something that's charged under the other copy, plus some singlet states here. And this representation theory, so what allowed states is that this dilatation operators act as exactly matches what we find on this ADS side of the duality. In particular, this reducible system. So at each site, we have a spin chain, but at each site, we have a choice of what sister. So either it's something in this representation, or we can choose it to be one of those. So this picture is very different from, say, the spin chain of n equal to 4, which is just a homogeneous chain where all the sites are the same. Now, the first stage to study of this system is to be BPS states, but to the half BPS states. So the half BPS operators satisfy the PSU 1.1.2 shortening condition, which is just that the dimension of the operator is equal to the sum of the left and right moving R charge. And from the PSU 1.1.2 algebra, you would expect these to be to not receive any anomalous dimensions. They should be protected. To construct such an operator, you need just this building block here. The minus half a half representation is half BPS under PC 1.1.2. And obviously, so is the singlet, the zero dimension and zero R charge. So if I take any of these blocks at the site, that gives a PSU one more, that gives a half BPS state. So I just need, I mean, if I take the highest weight state of each of the modules. So in particular, I take the scalar of the vector multiplet and one of the fermions of the adjoint hypermultiplets. And I just take any number of each, and all such state satisfy these shortening conditions. Now, that's a lot of states, because and this is a trace, and these are U, NC times NC matrices. So the ordering of state of the various fields is also important. So combinatorically, there's very many states here, and many, many more than you would expect from the string theory side, where you know what the BPS spectrum is. But here we can take a hint from our string theory calculations. Namely, the fermionic zero modes here should have some sort of non-trivial dispersion relations. So only the states where the fermions carry zero momentum along this spin chain should be actual protected states. The other ones should actually obtain anomalous dimensions. That might look weird, because they are half BPS. Since n equal to 4, that couldn't happen. Half BPS states can't be continuously deformed away. But in this case, you can actually join 4 half BPS states to form a long multiplet, which could have an anomalous dimension. So only the actual zero modes, so the completely symmetric states. So I take such a trace, I order all my fields in some order, and I just take the sum over all permutations without any factors, or maybe some factors from fermion signs, is what you would expect to be. That is your actual protected states. And if you count how many of those there are, we exactly reproduce the chiral ring of the supergravity in ADS3, S3T4, which also reproduces the chiral ring of the symmetric NT4 sigma model. So these are the protected states, but of course, just the protected states by themselves, or maybe it's not that a match, but we want to go beyond that. You don't need integrability to study this. So instead, I want to consider a set of operators, a sector, where I only take the scalar fields of the vector multiplet. But in the vector multiplet, there are four scalars. So you have to have a chain of scalars, and at each site, I choose one of the four. Now, if I choose all of these to be the highest weight state in the vector or in the field strength multiplet, then I get a half BPS state, and that state is protected. There's nothing it could join up with. So if I just take the same state at every site, the same field at every site, I get a half BPS protected operator. So, yes, so that is something we know. So what happens if we don't have that? Well, as I argued before, in planar gate theory, the dilatation operator to leading order can be written as something that acts on only two neighboring fields. So first it acts as these two, and then on the next two, and so on. Now, because we know that this system has SO4 symmetry, there is not very many ways you can write such an operator. So here's three tensors that can act on two SO4 vectors. You have the identity, just doesn't do anything to the SO4 indices. You have the permutation, which just exchanges the two. And you have the trace, which just traces two indices and gives back a trace. So from just SO4 invariance, we know that the result has to be a linear combination with some coefficients of these three terms. And because we know that this completely symmetric state is half BPS and actually protected, we know right away that this coefficient, the coefficients of these two tensors, has to be the same. because 1 minus p annihilates the state, but 1 plus p doesn't. And the trace, this is a traceless symmetric tensor, so the trace doesn't do anything. So we're left with essentially one parameter, because we can always, of course, we have one total normalization. We know that these two are the same, but the coefficients of k, the trace tensor, could be anything from just SO4 invariants. So this is some general SO4 Hamiltonian, nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. And, or if I could, of course, do the same counting in SON. But it's known that such a Hamiltonian is integrable only for a very particular choice of C3, of this relative coefficient between these terms and the trace term. And for SON, it's just 2 over n minus 2. So in particular, if I take SO4, I need to have C3 is 1. If C3 is 1, then this is exactly the Hamiltonian of the integrable SON model. And otherwise, the system is not integrable. So how do we find this for our system? Well, we do a bit of perturbation theory. So what we want to do, or what we need to do, is calculate Feynman diagrams that are logarithmically divergent, because these are the ones that contribute to the renormalization of the local operators. So there are, in principle, 4 topologies that could be involved when you just have scalar diagrams. This is this one, where we have this effective 4-point vertex of 2 scalars going to 2. There are 2 diagrams where the 2 scalars exchange a gluon. And there could be some self-energy diagram. However, we don't need to calculate all of these diagrams, because we only need to understand the diagrams that have a non-trivial flavor structure. In other words, I know that my resulting operator will be 0 when acting on a state which is a completely symmetric tensor from supersymmetry. So therefore, I only need to calculate, say, these 2 coefficients, because I know that this coefficient has to be the same as this coefficient, just from supersymmetry. So this diagram, for example, there is no flavor, and this is running between the lines. And similar here, this just acts on one side. So it will not give rise to any flavor interactions. I don't need to calculate it. I know that whatever this is need to be canceled by, I can fix that coefficient in the end if I want. Now, this diagram, on the other hand, is actually not divergent, so I don't need to calculate it. So the only thing that can contribute is this diagram. Now, the blob here, the fat blob, is this effective vertex, which is actually can be written out as a sum of different diagrams involving one loop, where the loop is of the integrated out hyper. But there's actually, of the different choices I have there, it's actually a single diagram that's both divergent and gives rise to some flavor interactions. And this is this diagram. So I have the scalars here, and I have a fermion loop, like this. Well, there are 2, I suppose, because you have left and right moving fermions. And if you look at just the flavor structure of this diagram, it turns out that it is exactly 1 minus p plus k. Which was the integrable SO4 spin chain Hamiltonian. So in other words, the dilatation operator in the scalar sector is exactly the form of an integrable SO4 spin chain Hamiltonian acting on these states. Now, note that something sort of remarkable happened here. So here, the result of just calculating this diagram is actually already of this form. So that means that any of these diagrams that were identity, so what I'm saying is that there's just a single diagram that contributes to this and this coefficient. But there are diagrams that you would expect to contribute to this coefficient, but you know that these two have to be the same, so those actually have to cancel from each other. That's different from, say, n equal to 4 CPA mills, where if you do the same calculations, there are many diagrams that would contribute to the corresponding coefficient here, which again don't have to calculate, but their contribution has to be non-zero. Here it just turns out that their contribution actually has to just vanish. Oh, I'm early. So this is the first hint we have had of, or direct derivation of integrable structure in this CFT2 dual. So let me now just give a summary of what I've said. So as I've discussed, the ADS3 CFT2 duality can be the one I'm talking about, can be obtained from the D1, D5 system. And integrability can help with understanding the spectral problem of this duality on both the string theory and conformal field theory side. So this D1, D5 system on the gauge theory side leads to 4.4 gauge theory, which flows to some non-trivial fixed point. So we have some superconformal field theory. So describe how you can obtain an effective action of this CFT on the Higgs branch. And explained how this construction, which leads to, this effective action leads to a natural spin chain picture of local operators in the planar limit. So note that this step was important here because in our original action, when we just wrote to the IR, we have both adjoint and fundamental matter, which doesn't at all lead to a spin chain picture. You don't have just a chain of operators because you can form singlets from your fundamental matters. You have mesons, but mesons. But because we want to study the states localized as the origin of the Higgs branch, turns out that the good description of these states is actually in terms of just adjoint variables, which does lead to a natural spin chain picture. Finally, I presented a brief where I showed that you can make a perturbative calculation of this spin chain Hamiltonian or dilatation operator in a scalar sector of the theory. And this showed that the one loop dilatation operator is identical to the Hamiltonian of the integrable SO4 spin chain. And note that even though this is a very small sector, SO4, that's just an SU2 times an SU2, this is not completely fixed by supersymmetry. So if it was just an SU2 sector, by supersymmetry, you would have just 1 minus P, and that's the only thing you could get. But here, there's actually one coefficient which you need to fix to get an integrable system. So what can we do further? Firstly, we could ask if there is a local description of the system. So here we have the action I've talked about today. It's a non-local, as Shota said, effective action for the variables in the vector multiplet. Now, if we take a simpler example, the Schwinger model, which is essentially the same thing, except it's just a U1. It's Maxwell theory with fermions, and you integrate out the fermions. In that case, you can obtain a non-local action completely analogous to the one I'm discussing today. But the system you obtain in the IR is actually just a Westermann-Witten model. Now, similarly, Aron and Barkus has argued that in the U1 case, so not the large NC limit, which I'm discussing today, but in the U1 case, they actually do find a SO4 supersymmetric Westermann-Witten model in the IR. Of course, in the non-abelian case, this is much more complicated, but could still hope that or think that there would be some nice description of this. Another thing one could try to do is just extend the either calculation, or you would probably want to do it using just making better use of all the symmetry in the problem, but just extend this spin chain Hamiltonian not only to small scalar sectors, but also including other operators, in particular including the adjoint hypermultiplets, which have a connection to the massless modes on the ADS3 side. Particularly, we saw that inserting a fermion from the adjoint hypermultiplets acted like a fermionic zero mode in the BPS operators. Of course, you would also like to go beyond the spectral problems. Calculate three-point functions in the CFT. And for example, ask, do this even something as simple as BPS three-point functions. Just take 3 half BPS operators, calculate the three-point function. This is actually a protected quantity also for 4.4 2D theory, and should hence match a similar calculation either on the string series, so supergravity side, or in the symmetric N orbit fold. And of course, there is the question about how to take winding modes into account. So the hypermultiplets, the adjoint hypers, well, all the hypers, actually come from a D5 brain wrapped on a T4. You can't really make a hypermultiplet periodic. So the question is, how do you take this into account? And is it related to winding modes on the actual torus on the ADS3 side of the duality? There's also interesting generalizations you can make of this whole story. So as I mentioned before, you can study not only backgrounds supported by Ramon-Ramon flux, but by mixture of Ramon-Ramon and Nevers-Schwarz flux. And on the string theory side, we have done most of the, there you can just go ahead and do the full calculations and just some general mixture of the two. And most formulas become much more ugly, but there's no conceptual problem with this. The question is what happens on the CFT side once you turn on the two. Similarly, there's the ADS3, S3, S3, S1 background, where again, on this ADS, on the string theory side, it's just a bit more technical involved, but conceptually it's not more different to study than the thing I presented here. But on the CFT side, very little is known about the CFT dual of this background. Now, recently, soon 2 years ago, there was a proposal by David Tong for what the UV gate theory corresponding to the dual of this is. So in the same way that I started here with the D1, D5 system and the 2D gauge theory living on that, he was looking at the D1, D5, D5 prime system. Now this is a 0.4 gauge theory, but he argued that this 0.4 gauge theory actually does flow to a CFT with a large 4.4 superconformal symmetry. And it would be interesting to see if one can do a similar construction as the one I presented here, starting with this gauge theory. Though again, this would be technically much more involved. Finally, would be interesting to see if there's any connection or how to connect what I'm talking about to the descriptions at other points of the CFT2 moduli space. In particular, there's a point where the CFT is just a Westermann-Witten model. Maybe it's our point, and maybe it's somewhere else. There's a symmetric N D4, which is sort of the more traditional description of the CFT. But it's not clear where in the modular space of CFTs this is actually living and how to relate that to the strings dual to the CFT dual to the free strings in ADS3. And finally, recently there have been a lot of studies of higher spins in ADS3, which are again related to the symmetric NT4 model, which actually has not only 4.4 supersymmetry, but a whole W infinity symmetry. And that would also be interesting to see if there is a similar symmetry in the model I've been describing today. So thank you.
Symmetry in the excitation picture? What's the symmetry of the S matrix?
So you're breaking PSU 1.1/2 down to, I've been calling it PSU 1/1 to the 4. So it's just, but with three central charges, if you want.
And how do the massless modes affect the spectrum?
You mean in the interaction picture?
Yeah, there is a new from the string theory point of view.
Yeah, so what happens, so you have your excitations transform under this central extended algebra, some 8 supercharges. And the massless mode just add an extra representation of your algebra. So say in n equal to 4, in ADS5, all excitations transform in one irreducible representations, but here you have just several representations.
So masses mostly scatter with each other as well?
Yes.
Is there an trivial matrix between the masses mode?
Yes.
And are there left and right movers? And is there a scattering between left and left, left and right, and both, or just?
There is. And the reason this can happen is that the dispersion relation is not just linear. So the mass, I call them massless modes, but they actually have a sine p over 2 dispersion relation. So if you had an actual relativistic massless mode, then two excitations with the same momenta do not scatter. But because you have a non-trivial dispersion relation, or sine p over 2, the group velocity is not the same as the velocity of the package. So there can be a non-trivial scattering. But this is a bit tricky to see in perturbation theory, because there you expand around the relativistic point. So it's quite subtle to do there, but in the like S matrix picture, that's no issue.
So how does that dispersion relation behave at weak coupling?
But it depends.
That dispersion relation is said it's G times sine of P over
2. It's just that. So that's a good question, how to actually obtain that in a spin chain picture. That's very non-trivial, because it almost looks like it should come at half a loop, because the normal ones, an expansion of the massive.
So it must mean that you have an interpolated
H squared
function as well. That is G is not G, but some F G that goes to the square of the coupling.
Yeah, something like that. Though perturbatively, you don't have an interpolation at two loops on the string side. So. But that doesn't say anything.
And the symmetry of the S matrix, is it enough to constrain the S matrix, the symmetry you
said? It is. So the issue is that your excitations transform in more than one representation. So if I take, I have actually 4 different representations in which my excitations transform. And for each pair of representations, the two-particle S matrix is completely constrained. But then there is a normalization factor, a relative factor between the different blocks. And that's not fixed by supersymmetry. So in other words, you have not one dressing face, but many.
You fixed those as well.
But those you can fix.
You found crossing and you solved them?
Yes. Now, the question is how to say you have the correct solution. But But we have solutions.
Is there a TVA for this system?
No, not at the moment. I assume there is, but I don't think anybody wrote anything down.
Your scales are compact, right? Prioritizing the people.
Yeah, in principle, yes.
One of your last questions was how to include the binding mode instead to consider scalars in the twisted sectors. Compactification.
Yeah, something like that. But it's, I think that's very complicated because you're part of a hypermultiplet. Understanding is that you can't just extend that. So that's why we're taking a limit where the T4 is somehow large, both to get rid of the D5-5 strings, but also to hopefully not have to care about the fact that they're compact and, until later, at least.
Do you integrate them out? Do you take into account the fact that they're compact?
No, we don't. So that you should do, of course. Yeah.
Basic question. If you do know that it can't the full S-matrix and so on, why there is
no TVA? I mean, nobody wrote it down. And I don't think the full S-matrix is published yet. So, but we're first writing down the solution to the crossing equation. Now, that's a good question, how you see the Virasoro, because the clearly manifest symmetry is PSU112 square, where the SU11 is just SL2 part of Virasoro. The question is what the higher Virasoro operators should do. And I think the answer is that the Virasoro operators actually mix single particle and multi-particle states. So if you just look at the spectral problem, the two-point functions, there is no Virasoro, really. Yeah, but these would be suppressed by 1 over n, I believe. So. Yeah, it was multi-trace, say. Or you want to. Yeah, so high Virasoro makes single and multi, always makes single and multi-trace. So these should be suppressed in the planar limit, actually. Which is a bit sad because maybe we can't make use of them, but that explains why you don't see it as a symmetry. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So if you do want to go beyond the spectrum, then it will of course be important, or hopefully visible.
Very naive question.
Yep.
In SO4 is SO2 times SO2.
Yes.
So can't I write the Hamiltonian as saying that it's A times identity plus B times permutation of the left times the same thing for the right? And if so, given that both halves will be manifestly integrable, shouldn't it be integrable for any value of constants?
You would think so, but you can also write 1 minus permutation, tensor 1 minus permutation. So that's your third term. So you have three terms. You have 1 minus permutation, tensor identity. You have the term in the other order, but you also have 1 minus permutation, tensor 1 minus permutation. And these tensors actually